From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mary Carr, her best-selling memoir, The Liars Club, about growing up in a small town in East Texas, is one of the most highly regarded memoirs of the past decade. Her follow-up, Cherry, just came out in paperback. It's about her early teen years and the confusion and self-consciousness surrounding her early sexuality. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Susan Isaac's new novel, Long Time No See, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews HBO's World War II miniseries, Band of Brothers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Stock prices dropped sharply today after the release of a worse-than-expected unemployment report. The Labor Department said unemployment hit a four-year high of 4.9% in August. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The government said businesses cut 113,000 jobs from their payrolls during the month, much more than economists had expected. Manufacturing was especially hard hit, losing 141,000 jobs. The report suggests that the economy may be somewhat closer to a recession than it appears, and it makes it all the more likely that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates again soon. In the past, the prospect of lower interest rates would have sent stock prices higher, but investors have grown especially pessimistic about the economy after a barrage of bad news this summer, and many were discouraged by the report. All the major stock indexes were down sharply, and the Standard & Poor's 500 index fell to its lowest level of the year. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
President Bush told reporters today he's worried about the latest unemployment figures. Mr. Bush called Republican leaders Dennis Hastert and Trent Lott to the White House to talk about the economy, unemployment, and the budget. Advisors say the president is considering a proposal to keep the Social Security surplus off limits to lawmakers looking for ways to pay the nation's bills. The plan would create a new mechanism that would trigger across-the-board spending cuts if the economy gets worse. The Bush administration won't say if it will appeal a court decision blocking implementation of its prescription drug discount card program. But officials do say they're not giving up on the idea. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
A federal district court judge Thursday night blocked the administration from announcing the private company selected to offer discount drug cards to Medicare beneficiaries. The judge was acting in a suit brought by pharmacy groups who said Medicare officials lacked the authority to implement the plan without congressional approval. But Medicare Administrator Tom Scully said the fight is not over.
We were trying to go as quick as we could to get this program up and running, and we thought we did it responsibly, and we're certainly going to heed the judge's order. But we're going to try to go ahead and do it if we can.
One possibility would be getting Congress to authorize the program on an expedited basis. But even that is likely to face substantial opposition. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
An investigation is underway in Miami involving an alleged cover-up of three police shooting deaths. 13 current and former Miami police officers are facing charges. The shootings resulted in three deaths and one injury during the late 1990s. Prosecutors say at least three shootings were followed by police planting of guns at the scene. U.S. Attorney Guy Lewis says the suspects put a stain on the badge of every good, hardworking police officer. Unemployment report sent stock prices sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 235 points to 9606. The Nasdaq was down 18 at 1688. You're listening to NPR News. Venus and Serena Williams will play for the U.S. Open Tennis Championship tomorrow night in New York. It's the first time in 117 years the two sisters have played each other in the final of a Grand Slam tournament. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
As Venus and Serena Williams have risen to the top of women's tennis, there have been questions about whether their close relationship hinders their ability to compete on court. But Friday, in their semifinal matches, it appeared they were downright eager to face each other in the U.S. Open final. Serena overwhelmed number one-ranked Martina Hingis 6-3, 6-2 in less than an hour. Venus Williams beat Jennifer Capriati 6-4, 6-2. Capriati was trying to win her third major tournament of the year. She led 4-1 in the first set, but Williams roared back thanks to her powerful ground strokes and serve, winning 11 of the next 13 games. Now the Williams sisters become linked through history history to Maud and Lillian Watson. In 1884, Maud beat Lillian for the Wimbledon title, the last time sisters played for a Grand Slam championship. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Chevron has gotten the green light to proceed with its acquisition of Texaco. The Federal Trade Commission voted 4-0 to approve the deal, valued at least $39 billion. The new company, to be named Chevron Texaco, will be the country's second-largest oil company, but it will still lag far behind the big multinationals ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell Group, and BP Amoco. High winds are creating problems for firefighters battling a big wildfire in Montana. A fire near Oroville now threatens more than 200 homes, and a blaze west of Yosemite National Park has scorched nearly 2,000 acres. 9 communities have been evacuated, and the fire is threatening the water supply. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Laura and Gary Lauder for support of the NPR Endowment, for support of the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, and helping to develop NPR online at www.npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mary Carr is the author of one of the most highly regarded memoirs of the past decade, The Liars' Club. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani described it as one of her generation's most eloquent, heart-grabbing memoirs, a pitch-perfect account of her childhood in a hardscrabble East Texas town. Dwight Garner described The Liars' Club as one of the best books ever written about growing up female or growing up period in America. Carr's follow-up memoir, Cherry, has just come out in paperback. It covers her early teen years, when she was dealing with her sense of identity, sexuality, self-consciousness, and conflicts with parents and teachers. Carr grew up in Beaumont, Texas. She's now in her mid-40s and is a professor at Syracuse University. We spoke last year, when Cherry was first published. As the title of your new memoir, Cherry, implies, a lot of your new memoir is about teenage sexuality and those early sexual awakenings, and you're very eloquent about that. Your mother, who as a teacher had seen a lot of pregnant teenagers, put you on the pill at about age 15, just in case. Did that encourage you to be sexual earlier
Absolutely,
than you might otherwise have been?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, I think she was trying to be progressive and certainly trying to prevent my getting knocked up, which was a common occurrence. In the town I grew up in. I mean, I had friends who were pregnant and married at 14. So, but at the time I wasn't even dating. I was this kind of, skinny, still a kind of borderline tomboy trying to, I was a recovering tomboy, I guess. So obviously, I mean, the amazing thing about this book, everybody thinks the title Cherry is ironic. And I think even despite that, despite my mother's sexual openness, again, which sort of nudged me in a way to be sexual long before I was prepared to, it's a book about discovering an innocence that I didn't believe I had. It's in no way ironic.
Well, you write that the way people talked about being deflowered, it was as if something you owned was stolen, something of worth ruined. Now, you had been raped at the age of 7. Did you feel like you had already lost that thing anyways, that part of you was already ruined?
Well, exactly. And again, I mean, I think when I first started writing this book, I was thinking of it as a book about the loss of innocence. And again, it became for me a kind of rediscovery of an innocence I didn't know I had, and an innocence, given my reckless behavior, I probably didn't deserve, even aside from what was inflicted on me as a child, what I volunteered for, in my teens. So, I think initially when I started writing the book, I believed, I threw away about 500 pages because they were all about this kind of, this steamy sexuality, which really I was superimposing the libidinal feelings of a 40-year-old woman and onto myself at 12, and I kept throwing them out because the pages seemed so perverted. And they were perverted. And they also happened not to be true. And at a certain point, I sort of clicked that, oh, I remember, I wanted this guy to skate over to me with a long-stem red rose. All my fantasies and all the imagery that I found so thrilling at that time, those images were all very courtly. The scenes I've been told are very racy are entirely chaste.
We talked about all the pages about early sexuality that you took out. Let's hear a passage that you wrote and kept in. And this is about the difference between what you were feeling as someone in your early teens with a boy who's about 4 years older than you are. I think you're around 15, he's around 19 in this.
Yes.
And you know that you're experiencing this little sexual interaction very differently.
It's either spectacularly sad or spectacularly innocent that while your solar plexus churns and all your body rushes with desire, you don't long to unzip Phil's pants or otherwise dismantle his clothing. Nor do you even get so far in fantasy as to actually envision sex, the brute carnality and mechanics of which would ruin all the verdant, soft, focused power of his kisses. It would slip you both from eternal time into the time of furrow and field, entering and leaving, start and, no please God, finish.
What were some of the other differences in retrospect you feel that you and the boys you were with were experiencing differently about early sexuality?
Well, I think the culture doesn't have a language for girls being sexual at this age. There's not much language for women being sexual, but there's some. But I think it's just part of common parlance. I mean, there's no word like chubby. There's no word comparable to the word chubby for a girl to describe arousal that's so childlike in a way and kind of innocent and silly. You know, I think of my son teasing his friends, boy, I bet you take really long showers. Or my nephew came to visit me once with a locked briefcase, and I think he was about 14, and we were flying up from Texas, and I said, so what's in there, your Playboys? And he turned to me very sharply and said, you looked. And again, it wasn't, you know, I can't think of anything comparable. And again, I think that's partly because the ways we feel don't ding the cultural bell as erotic. They aren't so carnal. I wasn't hardwired to get the deed done, perhaps in the way a 17-year-old boy might have been.
You write in the book about how after, you know, smooching with a boy, the next morning you'd look in the mirror and you'd think, you know, what was I thinking? You know, looking in the mirror, you think, I'm not that person I thought I was.
Yeah, I think I use the phrase, you know, that there was some schism between the kind of wild luxury of these kisses and this kind of, you know, scabby-looking girl, you know, who still looks partly like a child. Yeah, I went on a date with some guy who was just a guy, who was just a kind of regular fella, you know, nice. I had no particular passion for him and wound up kissing him. And the feelings that prompted at the time were so out of line with my relationship with this guy. I mean, I guess it's a common enough occurrence, isn't it? But yeah, I felt that, you know, I felt sort of lopped off from that person. Like, who was that? What was that? And I avoided this boy like the plague because I was so embarrassed by having, you know, made out with him at the drive-in like this. I found it very embarrassing.
Oh, and I like this, too. Once before being with a boy, you said you wanted to take a shower and brush your teeth, but being concerned with hygiene at such an instant would sound so uncool. And you also are unsure that cleaning up would help. It's the whole blunt corporeal exchange that's eating away at you.
It really is. I mean, you know, it's, again, I felt like with this particular boy, who was my first lover, who was really a very sweet boy and smart and kind. But as soon as we'd slept together, I had that sense of, oh, my God, everything we'd been doing before was sort of what I liked, was sort of kissing and staring into each other's eyes for hours on end. And I could see for him that had all been this kind of, you know, erotic cheese and crackers that was sort of beside the point, and once you'd sort of crossed over that line, his experience was just very different than mine was, and yet I had envisioned him as my soulmate, this boy who understood everything about me, and we were so similar, and it was so great that we'd found each other so young, because we were going to have this fabulous life together. I mean, I was 15 years old, and to suddenly see in this guy's face that in fact, you know, he's hardwired to get the deed done, that our experiences were so different.
My guest is Mary Carr. Her new memoir is called Cherry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Carr. Her memoir, Cherry, about her early teenage years, has just been published in paperback. What were some of the books, movies, TV shows, music that formed your romantic fantasies in your early teens?
Oh, it's funny. I mean, I think of that Nick Hornby novel, High Fidelity, mm-hmm. you know, about how you're sort of shaped by pop music in this awful way. Books and Anna Karenina was, I think, my favorite novel, is still one of my favorite novels, which is this romantic tragedy in which a woman betrays her husband, and then because of the nature of the betrayal, you know, she winds up a suicide. I mean, it couldn't be more operatic or unfortunate in terms of where a woman's libido is going to lead her. Songs, pop songs, I'm trying to think. Well, I listen to the Beatles, I listen to Joni Mitchell, I also listen to a lot of blues. I mean, I grew up in a place, I grew up not far from where Janis Joplin was born. And so, you know, the idea that you were going to suffer at the hands of some man was sort of built into the deal.
You mentioned Anna Karenina and suicide. You tried suicide when you were in your teens. You swallowed a whole bunch of Anisins. What provoked that?
It's funny, I don't think of it as trying suicide so much as it felt to me like a gesture in retrospect. It didn't feel quite as dramatic as I meant it to be. And in fact, I sort of intended the scene in the book to be comical because I sort of put on my black dress and lay down and crossed my hands over my chest, and my neighbors were yelling at each other outside the window, and I thought, you know, Socrates didn't have to deal with this. You know, he had Crito saying, "Please, master, tell us something else." And my attempt with a handful of Anison sort of lacked that drama or seriousness. You know, my home was unstable and I was depressed. I was depressed. I mean, whether that was hormonally prompted or endemic to my nature, or certainly, you know, it's a result of having a very chaotic household.
When you realized that your suicide wasn't going to have the drama of Socrates and the gravity of Socrates, did that ruin the kind of romance of suicide and make it something not worth messing around with again?
I never, after that, turned a hand to myself. I never... Now when I'm upset, I sometimes consider homicide. It stopped seeming like a solution, even though the poetry of darkness or dark sensibility or depression, you know, Keats's Ode to Melancholy, I've been half in love with easeful death, you know, and certainly there's a lot of great art that surrounds that kind of despair. I just wrote an introduction to The Wasteland for the Modern Library. I mean, that's a classic example of someone creating a kind of psychic landscape where suicide might indeed be a logical extension. But yeah, I think it seems to me now really cowardly. And my mother had threatened suicide. She never really did anything about it, but frequently, I think, when she was overwhelmed, that was her solution. So it ceased to be an answer to anything and became a kind of cowardly act.
You know, actually, you wrote a poem about suicide that's published in a recent collection of poems, and I'd like you to read that poem for us. And this is in a book called Viper Rum, and the poem is called Incant Against Suicide.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I should mention that I got a letter from a psychiatrist in New York saying that he's given this poem to so many of his patients. I was very moved by that. I mean, It's nice if you can help. Incant against suicide. Buy neither gun nor blue-edged blade. Avoid green rope, high windows, rat poison, cobra pits, and the long vanishing point of train tracks that draw you to horizon's razor. Only this way will another day refine you. Natural death's no oxymoron. Your head's a bad neighborhood. Don't go there alone, even if you have to stop strangers to ask the way, and even if spiders fall from your open mouth. This talk's their only exit. How else would their scramble from your skull escape? You must make room first that the Holy Spirits might enter. Empty yourself of self, then kneel down to listen.
I like that poem a lot, especially your head's
Thank you.
A bad neighborhood. Don't go there alone. It's
exactly.
Very funny.
Well, does, you know, I still have that. I mean, I you know, I don't get that kind of black depression I describe in my book. But, you know, my head will talk to me of a given day. It will start prattling at me. But I'm better at turning the volume down on it.
How do you do that?
Physical exercise, which generates endorphins, but sort of the way I say in the poem. I mean, I talk to people. If I'm feeling bad, I have a number of friends, and I'm not above going to see a mental health professional. I'm happy to get professional help if it'll help. If it'll shut my head up. I haven't been in therapy. I haven't been in long-term therapy for more than a decade, but, you know, it's the way all of us heal ourselves is you find people to love you, you know, people who will buy your act. And, you know, to have someone sitting across from you with a caring expression on your face when you're talking about your pain is comforting. I also go to church. I mean, I converted to Catholicism, so I pray.
When did you convert?
97.
How come?
My son came into my room, he was about 5 years old, one Sunday morning, and he said, I want to go to church. And I wanted to read the New York Times, so I said, why? And he said, I want to see if God's there. And I thought, oh, you know, I didn't like soccer either, but I went and stood out on the frozen field, you know, watched him run up and down. So we did this thing we called God-a-rama, where anybody we knew who had a spiritual practice of any kind, we went with them. So we went to a number of Jewish temples, including conservative temples and small private groups. We went to Baptist churches, Episcopal, Unitarian. We even did a Buddhist Zendo. We never made it to a mosque, but I found myself in a Catholic church that a friend of mine, actually, Tobias Wolf, had invited me to. And I was very moved. And if you told me I would join the Catholic Church, I just would have laughed myself sick. And I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic. I mean, let me just put it that way. But I go to church every Sunday, and I pray every day. I think it puts me in perspective, I think. It puts my difficulties in the right size.
Now, your first memoir, The Liars Club, was a bestseller. It was also, you know, important in popularizing the memoir. Why did you first decide to write a memoir?
It's a form that always interested me. I write in this book, the only journal that I have from ever, really. I never really kept a journal. But the only journal I have from childhood, in that I write, when I grow up, I want to write half poetry and half autobiography. I don't even remember an autobiography I read as a child. So the form always interested me. I started teaching classes in it when I was teaching composition and rhetoric in the academic ghetto around Boston. I often taught courses in family memoir. I think I wanted to know how people live their lives. I had tried to write Liars Club as a novel, and when I did, the character who was me behaved way better in fiction than I ever had in fact. You know, she was beautiful and noble and wise. She did volunteer work at the nursing home. I mean, for me, fiction would have been an opportunity to correct. And I also, I was endowed with these amazing characters. I don't know. I think it's a psychological tilt. You know, why does Philip Roth write books that, you know, he basically admits are autobiographical, and yet they're labeled fiction. You know, I don't know. I think it must be the writer's psychological position.
Now, I know you kept a diary as a girl. Did a lot of your memoir come from memories revived by that diary?
Virtually none of it. Actually, that's not true. I mean, what I discovered from that, it's less than one volume. I mean, it's not very thorough. I was a lazy kid, I think, intellectually. And so I'd keep it for a few days or a week, and then I'd kind of stop and get disinterested. But for instance, you know, I think we remember ourselves in convenient packages, and I like to remember myself as very smart at this age. And I had been a very smart little girl. I think I was precocious. I read very early at age 2.5. But when I read the poems I had written in 1965, it was very clear that even though I occasionally had the sense to read E.E. Cummings or Shakespeare, I in fact wasn't very smart. You know, I was writing love poems to the star of Branded, you know, and drawing pictures from Song of Bernadette, you know, drawing pictures of Jesus. So I think, again, I had very conveniently remembered myself as being this great intellect. And in fact, I was just kind of an average kid in terms of intelligence, probably. I mean, I was more interested in reading because I think my family was. But
do you keep a journal now?
Oh, goodness, no. I don't have time. And I also lead a pretty banal life. I mean, in many ways, I'm a soccer mom, you know. I live in Syracuse. I teach at Syracuse University. And I have a son. I'm a single mom, although my ex-husband is great, and we co-parent really well, and he's very involved in raising our son. I sort of live in this Country Time lemonade commercial, is the way it looks. All the things that everybody in the 50s were trying to escape, I'm trying to recreate, you know, in the year 2000. And, you know, this sort of, I have a picket fence, you know, I mean, the whole shoot and match, you know, and I stand out on the soccer field and watch kids run up and down and shoot hoops in my driveway when my son comes home from school.
Mary Carr is the author of The Liar's Club and Cherry. Cherry has just been published in paperback. We'll hear more from Carr in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Book Magazine, for the passionate reader, featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines, in bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. And from Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel by Margaret Atwood, The Blind Assassin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing memoirs when you know that memories are often inaccurate. We continue our conversation with Mary Carr. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Susan Isaac's new novel, Long Time No See, and David Bianculli reviews HBO's World War II miniseries, Band of Brothers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Mary Carr. Her memoir, Cherry, has just been published in paperback. It's a follow-up to her best-selling memoir, The Liars Club. Both books are about growing up in a small town in East Texas. Cherry covers her early teen years. When we left off, we were talking about the process of writing memoirs and keeping journals. What about memory, though? You know, your two books, outside of your poetry books, have been memoirs, which requires remembering. And I don't know if you experience this, but sometimes memories really start to disappear and you're able to remember less and less, and you trust less and less the things you are able to remember. So isn't there the temptation to keep a journal just to kind of preserve what it is that you've experienced and know that you experienced it?
Well, I mean, if I were going to do that, I'd strap a video camera to my head, you know. I mean, for me, a memoir is an act of, I mean that seriously in a way. For me, a memoir is an act of memory and not an act of history. So, I mean, it's remembered experience. It's not lived experience. You know, there are all kinds of theories about ways we remember, and I have no doubt that my memory is as... I do have a better long-term memory than most people. You know, that I write, I basically wrote this book and I gave it to all my friends, and no one said that didn't happen or that didn't happen that way. People told me things I didn't remember, or they augmented events, or they told me how they felt that I didn't, in ways that I had no way to know. But, you know, it's a corrupt form. You know, memory informs imagination, and imagination informs memory. So when people ask me how I remember all this stuff, I always say, well, obviously I don't. I just think I do, which I think is true.
You know, one lives through life trying to keep certain unpleasant things kind of secret from other people. It's certainly not the first thing that you tell them. I mean, you don't meet somebody and say, by the way, and I was abused when I was 7, you know. But when you've written a memoir, before people even meet you in person, they may have read your book and found out all these, you know, really private, personal things that you probably kept secret from most people for most of your life. So I'm wondering if that's changed your interactions with people who you're meeting now, because if they've read your work, they know so many things.
It's funny. I have a great switch that I've thrown. You know, I've never reread The Liars Club, and wouldn't. You know, I managed to not remember or not know that people know those things. I think people are actually kinder to me in some way, or they feel they know me when they meet me. And so I think, in some ways, people are much more open with me, perhaps, than they would have been. They feel as if I've let them in on something, which I guess I have, even though I managed to deny that. And I also, like most writers, I'm never interested, really, in talking about something I've already written. Once it's written, I'm kind of done. So if someone comes up to me and says, oh, you know, that part where your mother has a psychotic break in Liars Club was so important to me, I usually say something like, you know, thank you very much. Why do you think you were so interested in that? Did you have anything like that in your family? And you know, I'm not... Martin Amis has a great line I think he stole from Ian McEwan, which is, you go on the road or you start talking about a book you've already written and you become an employee of your former self.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that good?
Yeah.
And so my interest in talking about... I would still talk about those events intimately if they came up. If they came up in my psyche with people I'm close to. But otherwise, I mostly just don't talk about it.
When was it in your life, would you say, that you knew you wanted to write?
When I was 5. We had this big edition of Riverside Shakespeare. My sister still has it. You know, I sort of am trying to bully it away from her. But that I actually used as a booster seat when I was a little kid. So my mother was always so interested and excited if I recited poetry to her. She would just sit with her chin in her hands and look enthralled. Which when you're a kid and you have a mother who's kind of eccentric and whose attention is a little bit hard to get, you know, it causes you to be interested in that stuff. So if When I was 5 years old, if you asked me what I wanted to do, I would have said I wanted to be a poet. And that basically never changed. There was a brief time when I used to say I wanted to be a journalist. My mother had written for a newspaper, and I always liked newsrooms to walk in. And at that time, you know, there were the typewriters that clacked and all that. I thought it was really exciting. But basically, I never wrote any journalism, so, you know, it was always poetry. So,
I have a kind of technical question about your memoir. Most of it is written in first-person past tense. You're telling the story about an earlier part of your life. But the first chapter is written in the second person. It's written in the you, as if, you know, you're waiting for the car to come. You're waiting to leave your hometown. Why did you write in the you in that first chapter?
Well, it's funny because I actually do it. I take that up again later. In the last section, I also go to second person present. I go to second person present tense, whereas in the prologue, I think it's second person past tense, mm-hmm. which has a more elegiac feeling to it. And I start in first person past, and then I do first person present. I sort of was trying to change the voice slightly because I did have a sense of myself changing. I had a sense of estrangement from myself in high school, and I don't know if it was drug-induced or if it had to do with my hormonal levels or if I was depressed, but I thought to write in the first person just didn't convey that sense of estrangement from myself that I had, that kind of abstracted way the world was coming at me. Again, I think I didn't much have a self. I was kind of assembling this self, and, you know, when I was a kid, even though it was a kind of a self that had been donated to me in some ways by genetics and my family situation, I at least was responding to things with some natural impetus out of some natural core, I think. And I was much more self-conscious at this age and was always kind of looking at myself, you know. I mean, you know, the hours I spent worrying about my pores was just astonishing.
You have a teenage son now, yes?
He just turned 14, yeah.
Right, okay, and that's part of the age that's covered in your memoir. Do you want your teenage son to read your memoir and in the hopes perhaps that it would help him understand something about girl sexuality, or do you think if he read the memoir he'd be learning more than he needs to know about his mother?
The latter. I mean, obviously, I have no investment in his reading either of the books, and in fact, and he hasn't read either. And he just turned 14. I don't think he needs to know anything about girl sexuality. I'm his mom, you know, that's my little bitty baby boy. But we actually had some interesting conversations about it. He came home a couple of years ago and burst in the door and said, I can read any memoir I want for English. And I thought, this is my big moment. And he said, and I'm going to read This Boy's Life.
Oh, great. That's a good book by Tobias Wolff, who's a friend of yours.
He's a friend of mine who's also Dev's godfather. And so I sort of breathed a sigh of relief. But this summer, he said to me, I think it was the New Yorker excerpt at Cherry, and I think it was when the excerpt came out, and he looked at the picture, but he didn't read it. And he said, you know, Mom, I don't think I'm ready to read either of these books. And I said, you know, I have no vested interest in your reading either one of them. I mean, if you ever want to talk to me about anything that's in them, I can do that. I'm happy to do that. But, you know, he's a kid. He wants to know me in my pajamas, sort of, I intend this book to be a work of art, and I don't think he wants to know me as an artist. He wants to know something sort of more fundamental, something that's going to actually get him some French toast in the morning. But I remember Toby Wolff's sons didn't read This Boy's Life until I think he made it a contingency of their seeing the movie. So I think that's kind of common for the sons and daughters of writers. Possibly, I don't know. I remember meeting Dmitri Nabokov and hearing him talk about his father's work, and obviously I should be so lucky as to write so well or to have a son so devoted to my writing.
Mary Carr recorded last fall after the publication of her memoir, Cherry. It's just been published in paperback. In May, we dedicated a show to singer Susanna McCorkle after she committed suicide. We had a big response to the broadcast, and many listeners asked where they could find a song that she'd performed for Fresh Air called The Warders of March. Well, that song is included on a new posthumously released CD called Susanna McCorkle Most Requested Songs. It collects tracks from her CDs dating back to 1977. She wrote the liner notes before she died. Here's what she said about this 1993 recording of The Warders of March. "This is my most requested song, and I love singing it every single time. By one of the great songwriters of our time, Antonio Carlos Jobim, this unusual composition always inspires me with its meandering lyrics, full of contrasting images, its sweet sadness, and its gentle but insistent spirit of survival and renewal." Here's the song.
É pão, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É o resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's feeling alone, it's the weight of your load. It's a sliver of glass, it's life, it's the sun. It's night, it's death, it's a knife, it's a gun. A flower that blooms, a fox in the brush. A knot in the wood, the song of a thrush. The mystery of life, the steps in the hall. The sound of the wind and the waterfall. It's the moon floating free. It's the curve of the slope. It's an ant, it's a bee. It's a reason for hope. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of spring. It's the joy in your heart. Eu pé, eu chão. É a marcha estradeira, passarinho na mão, pedra de atiradeira. E uma ave no céu, uma ave no chão. É um regato, uma fonte e um pedaço de pão. É o fundo do poço, o fim do caminho. No rosto desgosto, pouco sozinho. A spear, a spike, a stake, a nail. It's a drip, it's a drop. It's the end of the tale. The dew on the leaf in the morning light. The shot of a gun in the dead of the night. A mile, a must, a thrust, a bump. It's the will to survive. It's a jolt, it's a jump. A blueprint of a house, a body in bed. A car stuck in the mud. It's the mud, it's the mud. A fish, a flash, a wish, a wing. It's a hawk, it's a dove. It's the promise of spring. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the end of despair. It's the joy in your heart.
Susanna McCorkle from her posthumously released CD, Most Requested Songs. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Long Time No See, the sequel to Susan Isaac's 1978 bestseller, Compromising Positions. This is Fresh Air. The new novel by Susan Isaacs is called Long Time No See. For some of her fans, including book critic Maureen Corrigan, any length of time is too long to go without an Isaacs novel.
This past August was a dead time for books, but deliverance from literary despair has arrived with the splashy start of the fall publishing season. Already, the first book scandal has erupted. That business about Faye Weldon selling product placement space in her new novel to the jewelry firm Bulgari. The Authors Guild immediately protested this crass crossbreeding of high art with the commercial, but I don't think there's anything to worry about. Once Bulgari and other curious companies look at the low sales figures for literary novels, like the kind Weldon writes, they'll realize that advertising in literature is akin to advertising on Antarctica. The most telling line in the story the New York Times ran about the piece was that the chief executive of Bulgari, who originally came up with the idea of literary product placement, has never read any of Weldon's books. Along with the debut scandal comes the first sublimely good read of the fall, Susan Isaacs, Long Time No See. Isaacs is in that exclusive niche, occupied also by Maeve Binchy, of masterful writers for whom storytelling is not a shameful artistic act. If I ran the world, Isaacs would be showered with all those hoity-toity literary prizes that so far have been denied her. I can think of no other novelist, popular or highbrow, who so consistently celebrates female gutsiness, brains, and sexuality. She's Jane Austen with a schmear, or Philip Roth without the woman problem and the self-absorption. She's certainly their equal, if not in felicity of phrasing, then in her shrewd and hilarious social observations. Isaac's trademark first-person narrators, usually lower-middle-class Jewish women who've married up, are quintessential insiders-outsiders, and thus brilliantly positioned to offer canny takes on everything from WASP speech patterns to designer Tampax holders. But Isaacs hasn't gotten the literary respect she deserves because her strengths are also her weaknesses. She's a plus-size storyteller in an age when, narratively speaking, thin is in and rumination is valued more than plot. Also, many of her books are shelved, however haphazardly, within the disparaged category of detective fiction. I think the real answer to Isaac's image problem, however, is that she leaves her readers, her female readers especially, feeling too happy. A writer's reputation usually sinks in inverse proportion to the degree she or he raises their readers' spirits. The optimistic moral of Isaac's collected works is that down-to-earth, over-the-hill, funny women who are nothing special in the looks department can solve the crime, find true love, and/or defeat the Nazis if only they summon up enough pluck. Long Time No See is sure to win Isaacs more adoration from the masses and further scorn from the Academy. Sequels, after all, are among the lowliest of all literary genres, and Long Time No See is a sequel to Isaacs' first novel, the 1978 bestseller Compromising Positions. Yippee! That means the return of one of Isaacs' most beloved heroines, Judith Singer, the Shorehaven, Long Island, stay-at-home mother of two with a nose for danger. A sequel also means the return of Judith's best friend, that boozy Southern Belle man-trap, Nancy Miller, and Nelson Sharp, the dreamy homicide detective who ignited illicit sparks in Judith's bosom when he first stepped into her suburban Tudor living room. Nelson, we learn, has been out of Judith's life for decades. They ended their affair out of consideration for their kids. A lot else has changed. Judith is now 54 and a widow. Her overbearing but not completely awful husband died of a heart attack 2 years before this story opens. Judith has gotten her PhD and is teaching history at a local college. Her situation, that of a youngish widow still pining for an indifferent husband, allows Isaacs the opportunity to ruefully dramatize the loneliness of bright women rendered invisible by their age and the absence of a male partner. What lifts Judith out of her grief and maneuvers Nelson into her life again is yet another Shorehaven murder mystery. Courtney Logan, a former investment banker, wife, and mother of two toddlers, disappeared on Halloween night. Her body is eventually found in the family swimming pool. Courtney's husband is the police's prime suspect, but as of old, Judith can't help second-guessing the professionals. Along with discovering the identity of the murderer, Judith also finds out, with Nelson, that love is indeed lovelier the second time around. Beyond its wit and smart social observations, and the pleasure its central second-chance fantasy offers readers, Long Time No See also serves as a casual but unsettling commentary on the triumphs and shortcomings of the second wave of feminism. Compromising Positions was first published in the heady days of the women's movement. young Judith's consciousness was raised, but her resolve was weak. She still cooked Bob's dinner every night while confronting killers. Long Time No See gives us a sadder but more self-possessed Judith, one who earns her own living and refrains from rushing into another serious relationship with a man. At the same time, the younger women around Judith seem to have taken two steps back. In an alcohol-fueled discussion about feminism, her friend Nancy says to Judith, "I don't understand all these stay-at-home moms you're speaking to. What do they do? Remember jobs, Judith? Remember all those husbands in 1972, yours and mine included, who said, 'My wife isn't going to work,' and how we stood up to them and that idiot mentality. So what are all these women doing home?" That larger mystery about women's lives and the price of fulfillment remains unsolved. But in Long Time No See, a fully evolved Judith Singer seems to have achieved the two things that Freud said were necessary for happiness: work and love.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Long Time No See by Susan Isaacs. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews HBO's World War II miniseries, Band of Brothers. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, HBO presents the first two installments of a 10-part World War II miniseries called Band of Brothers. It's based on the nonfiction book by Stephen Ambrose. The executive producers are Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The reason Band of Brothers exists at all and has turned up on HBO is because of some of the previous work by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. Hanks had starred in Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, the World War II movie on which historian Stephen Ambrose served as an advisor, so the three of them already trusted one another. From that movie, they all knew the value and importance of making the battle scenes as intense and realistic as possible. From Schindler's List, Spielberg knew the value and the power of getting the real-life survivors on film. And Hanks, by producing HBO's From the Earth to the Moon, knew how to mount an ambitious, intelligent, large-scale TV miniseries, and why HBO, with its creative freedom, was the right place to do it. So with all that, it's no surprise at all that the 10-hour Band of Brothers is on HBO. It's not even a surprise that HBO paid $120 million for it. That's a ton of money by TV standards. But whatever HBO doesn't make up in new subscribers or home video and foreign sales, it'll earn in buzz. What is surprising, though, is how good it is. Band of Brothers tells the remarkable history of the Army's Easy Company, one unusually cohesive unit of the 506th Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. In Part 1, shown Sunday, we see their first members undergoing training. In Part 2, also on Sunday, we see them parachuting into France on D-Day. From that point on, we follow the Easy Company paratroopers and their younger and greener replacements to the Battle of the Bulge, to the frozen forests of Bastogne, to a Nazi concentration camp, and to Adolf Hitler's mountaintop retreat. Every episode, we get to know them a little better. And almost every episode, we're thrown into battle situations as intense and unrelenting as that unforgettable early section of Saving Private Ryan. Before too long, in Band of Brothers, you learn to fear the war and treasure the peace. Except for David Schwimmer of the sitcom Friends, who plays Easy Company's first commander, the actors in Band of Brothers are relative unknowns. Some of them give performances that should change all that, especially Damian Lewis as Richard Winters and Ron Livingston as his best friend in the company, Lewis Nixon. Spielberg doesn't direct here, but serves as executive producer with Tom Hanks. Hanks co-wrote one episode and directed another. He doesn't act in the miniseries, but his son Colin does, and he's really good. Nothing in the miniseries, though, is as powerful as the real-life veterans whose comments open the first 9 episodes and close the 10th. They aren't identified until the very end, when we have a strong appreciation for what they endured and accomplished. But from the very beginning, their words make Band of Brothers a haunting TV viewing experience.
Well, our country was attacked. It's a different. It wasn't like Korea or Vietnam. We was attacked. And, you know, it's a feeling that maybe we're just dumb country people, but where I come from, but a lot of us volunteered.
Who would like to volunteer for the Tank Corps? Who would like to volunteer for the Air Force? Who would like to volunteer for Navy or whatever? And then they said, who would like to volunteer for the Airborne? So we said, what the hell is the Airborne? Nobody ever heard of it.
We came
as a dramatic form, Band of Brothers is closest to two other miniseries I can think of. One is the British World War II drama Danger UXB, where the heroes were assigned the task of locating and disarming unexploded bombs dropped over England. The other is the American Western Lonesome Dove. In both of them, we got to know the characters very slowly, but very well. And because of the dangers constantly surrounding them, we knew we could lose them at any moment, and often did. The very best episode of Band of Brothers is number 6, which focuses on actor Shane Taylor as a company medic. But all of them are excellent and intense, and every one adds to the meaning and impact of the others. This is appointment television of the highest order. And even when it's tough to watch, it should be seen.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock, who also directed the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Rosemary Clooney.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut tree, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Total Recall, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, author of Hard Time, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Living in the Shadow of a Saint, we talk with Ken Wiwa. He's written a memoir about being the son of the executed Nigerian activist and writer Ken Sarah Wiwa. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.